Sai's Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Om Shri Sai Ram. Offering myself at Bhagwan's lotus feet, this is Karuna signing in live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. Good morning, welcome to Morning Glory on Thursday Live, coming to you from the Radio Sai Studios in Prashanti Nilayam, India. Till now, you were listening to this morning's Vedam and Bhajans that were coming to you live from the Sai Kulwant Hall. It is exactly 43 minutes past 9 a.m. on Thursday morning, August the 9th, 2018, and you're tuned to our Asia stream. Both the day and the date are auspicious today. It's a Thursday and the date is number 9, Swami's number. The morning Mangal Aarti has just concluded in the Sai Kulwant Hall and the devotees are quietly lined up for the darshan of the holy Mahasannidhi. The ashram atmosphere is still reverberating with the sacred energy of the Vedam and the bhajans that were sung by Bhagwan's blessed students. It's a very beautiful day here in Prashanti Nilayam with comfortable temperatures, lows of 23 degrees Celsius and highs of 31 degrees Celsius. It's a mix of sun and cloud. Generally, I would say the skies are overcast and occasionally we have short spells of rain for about exactly 3.2 minutes at a time. Sometimes it rains in my backyard, but not in the front of my house where I park my car in the hope of a free car wash from the sky. It's pleasant monsoon-like weather in Parthi, but the serious monsoon rains are awaited and I'm sure they are on their way because the universe is always listening to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. Now today on Morning Glory, we will continue the two grand stories of Sai Grace from two devotees, namely Mr. Ashok Srinivasan and Mr. Shashank Shah. And dear listeners, I promise you that each word of the two narratives is worth holding on to. That aside, I want to invite each one of you to join me virtually at my heaven, my blissful home, Prashanti Nilayam. So, dear sisters and brothers, please take a moment and mentally join me at the Mahasannidhi. Let us together, all of us as one family, bow our foreheads at the cool edge of the sacredest shrine on the face of the planet and leave all our cares to Him. And as we rise from the namaskar at the Mahasannidhi, let us feel the lightness of gratitude in our step. We are His children, we belong to Him, and to have Him lead our lives is our birthright. So let us please hand over everything that worries us or stresses us out to Him and walk away joyful and satisfied that He is in charge. It is Swami's responsibility to see us through and He will take care of each of our worries and guide us through the process. With that satisfaction, walk through the ashram's clean and pristine ambience. Enjoy the lush green surroundings, the gentle breeze, the beautiful blue sky dotted with fluffy white clouds. Listen to the peace of this ashram, the traffic noise-free peace that seeps deep into our soul, and make your way to the Radio Sai studios. Mr. Shashank Shah and Mr. Ashok Srinivasan are waiting to share their experiences with you. And I'm very happy to share them with you and play both the files for you. Thank you for your wonderful company, dear listeners, and have a Saisam blessed day ahead. Over now to Mr. Shashank Shah in conversation with Radio Sai's Bishop Prushti. This interview will be followed by a Triswe Divinity episode part 2, which is the conclusion of Bishu's interview with Mr. Ashok Srinivasan. And dear listeners, as always, we look forward to your feedback to all our offerings on Morning Glory or any other offering on Radio Sai. Our email ID for your feedback remains listener@radiosai.org. And many times, many of you write personally to each one of us, and I get a lot of requests from, especially from Anandpur alumni, asking me to find them this file or that file they want to listen to. The simple solution to all your confusion about locating a file on Radio Sai is to send your request to listener@radiosai.org. We always try our best to oblige and respond and send you the necessary link. So have a listen, please. Over to Bishu in conversation with Mr. Shashank Shah. Today I am playing part 2 of this 4-part interview. The remaining 2 parts will continue over the next 2 weeks. And the interview with Mr. Ashok Srinivasan concludes today. It's a 2-part episode. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of the show. Sai Ram.
So, each of those experiences, I've never had very larger than life experiences, but I've had very insightful experiences which reaffirm your inner connect with Swami, your thought processes, your prayers, and the way He responds to each one of them, and the churning that goes into it in order to reach the culmination. So this was one facet of that. And then came 2007, April, 10th of April. It's a very memorable day. So I'll tell you something a little more worldly. I had sent my first stipend to Swami, to his residence, with a thank you note. We have this tradition to send our first salary to our parents or something. So I wanted to give it to Swami. But I was very worried because students' money and Swami is a very, very sensitive area. So I didn't know how Swami will react. But still I said, no, I want to give. So I went and gave it inside. I gave it to Satyajit's brother saying, this is my gratitude to Swami. And he accepted it. We had the opportunity. Some of us had the opportunity to give it at Swami's residence. So I gave, and then I came back and I sat behind in the bhajan hall, a little more behind than where I used to sit, just hiding myself so that Swami doesn't see me. Because if he sees me and if he remembers that, he may, I don't know what would have been the outcome. So he came, and then he gave darshan, and then he came in the bhajan hall with that envelope which I had given in his hand a couple of hours back. And then he came inside the bhajan hall and he announced, Shashank Shah. So all heads turned towards me where I was sitting, and I had to go in front. And then Swami, I went near Swami's chair, and Swami said, Ye tum diya? Did you give this? I said, yes, Swami. He said, no, you should not give money to Swami like this. This is your stipend. This I have not given. This university has given. I still remember Swami said, this is for your boarding and lodging. He used those words. So don't give money to Swami. If you want something, you tell me. I will give. He said like that. And then he counted those notes which I had given, as if he is counting and giving it back to me. He counted the money, counted those notes, and then folded that envelope, pulled my upper shirt pocket and shoved it inside and said, keep it with you. This is for you. I still have those notes. Wow. In the post-demonetization era, I have not encashed them because they're much more valuable than the amount printed on them. And then he said, he looked at my hand, and he had given me another ring earlier. So he asked me, did I give you this? I said, yes, Swami. Then I put a small ring in front of it because it was a little loose. So he said, why have you put this? I said, Swami, it is loose. And then Swami materialized another ring for me and put it in my other finger. And he said, see, this is not loose. This is perfect size. And then he went back and sat down on the chair. Then I went back and sat. Then again he called me. A week earlier was my birthday. So I had written a letter to Swami said, Swami, you always call me Bombay boy or just Shah, or sometimes Swami used to call me fair boy, apparently used to refer to me that way. So I said, Swami, you never call me by my name. Please call me by my name. I will feel so happy to hear my name from you. And Ravi Kumar sir, the warden of Vrindavan campus, had shared with me in Kodaikanal. Swami used to always call him Ravi Kumar very formally. So once he had written to Swami, Swami, why don't you call me Ravi? I am your child. Why do you call me so formally? So that inspired me to write that letter. And I had written that letter, given to Swami in Darshan line on my birthday. And Swami had taken it and walked away. That day, when he called me again, he started talking about me and telling the boys around me. This Shashank, he got gold medal in MBA. This Shashank, he got gold medal in MPhil also. This Shashank got 5 out of 5 in all semesters. This Shashank, this Shashank, that. He kept on doing Shashank, Shashank, Shashank 8-10 times. And I was wondering, what is wrong with Swami? Why is he repeating Shashank, Shashank so many times? Till I went back and sat down and bhajan started. And in between the bhajan, it struck me that 1 week earlier, I had written to Swami, Swami, you never call me by my name. Why don't you call me by my name? So I made a prayer. I forgot about it. Apparently, he took the letter in the darshan line when there are hundreds of devotees giving a letter. He took it. He read it. He kept it in his mind in the midst of all the million tasks that he does. And a week later, when the opportunity came, he fulfilled that small desire of calling my name. Those words still keep ringing in my ears when I close my eyes sometimes and think about that experience. But something very important happened that time. He said, what are you doing now? You're doing your PhD. When are you finishing? I said, Swami, I will finish in 3 years. So then he looked up somewhere, and then again he came back and he said, as if he thought for a moment, and then he said, 2.5 years may try karo. Try to finish in 2.5 years. So I said, Swami, with your grace, I will finish in 2.5 years. He said, yes, yes, dandiga on the, I have lots of it, lots of my grace, and he patted my back. And then that continued to remain as my priority. I wanted to finish my thing because Swami had said in 2.5 years. In 2010, I was the last candidate that year to finish my viva on 13 November. It was Akhand Bhajan Day, I still remember. And 2010, 22nd November, I was the last one to receive the PhD from Swami's hand in that convocation. And then 2011 April, when Swami concluded his earthly sojourn, it struck me that why Swami had said,
wow,
finish in 2.5 years. Because if I wouldn't have finished in 2.5 years, I wouldn't have received the PhD from Swami's hands. I was the last candidate to have received PhD from his hand ever in his physical lifetime as the chancellor. So we always feel that Swami abruptly left, or Swami didn't tell, or Swami didn't indicate. But through so many experiences, and I can share a dozen more when Swami, and we can do an entire session on, and I've compiled how Swami has given indications over 12 years with dates and instances how that he's concluding his avatarhood. So it is our foolishness if we think that Swami left abruptly. This is one such personal example where he indicated that I should finish in 2.5 years. And because I listened to him, I got my PhD from his hands.
Wow.
And then in 2011, and before that, on 18th of Jan 2011, I just received the award that you mentioned, AIIMS International Outstanding Doctoral Research Student Award. So I had got that certificate and that medal, and I had gone to the Ajun Mandir to show Swami. It was like a culmination. He told me to do PhD, and here I had received an award with his grace, and I went to show it to him, and he was very happy. He touched it. He smiled. And that time he indicated that I should do my postdoc, my postdoctoral research in his university. So that's when I applied. And then in 2011, May, I joined as postdoc. But in 2011, April, I got a very interesting dream. Swami was that time in the hospital. And why I'm sharing all this is, now I'm showing you the continuity of how that Swami is the same Swami. For him, the omnipresence I experienced before, or the omniscience that I experienced before I came into his fold as a student, the physical experiences that I got when I was a student, and then my relation with him and my connect with him after he was physically not with us, have had a very seamless similarity of the way he interacts and communicates. So in 2011 April, I had a dream. Swami was that time in the hospital, but in the dream, we were all sitting in the mandir. And I was the coordinator of the Sai Publications division, as you mentioned. And there are so many interesting experiences even with Sai Publications. I mean, that responsibility came to me totally unasked. In fact, I was not wanting it because there were so many other things I was anyway doing. But on hindsight, that has been the best opportunity of my life for 6 years to have led that division and brought out almost 30 books on Swami's message to students. Was a great opportunity. So I was in my dream sitting and editing some discourse of Swami. And Swami had come for darshan, but I was so engrossed that I was not aware that he has come. And then he came and stood behind me in the dream. And I still didn't know that Swami was standing behind me. All of a sudden, all students started looking in my direction. So then I was wondering what happened. And then they were looking beyond me, above me. So then I turned behind, and then Swami was standing there. And then Swami said, "Very good." Because he saw me editing the discourses. He said, "You have to ensure that you interpret my message correctly, and you have to ensure that the devotees understand my message in the right context." And I didn't know why Swami was saying that, but after he left physically, I used this experience as an indication that we should continue the work that we were doing in Sai Publications, and we continued to bring out his message. And I kept this in mind, that very often we just quote Swami's message without giving the context or the interpretation, and many times it becomes like Chinese whispers. Swami had said something in some context, and then we dovetail it to suit our requirements in some other context, and the whole thing gets misinterpreted. So every time, even today, whenever I go to give talks or whenever I have an opportunity to share Swami's message, the interpretation and the context is very important. And that's when devotees come back and say that, "Oh, we had also heard this earlier, but we didn't know it was in this context, or this is the interpretation." And Swami has answered the question exactly the way we wanted to understand and practice in our lives. So the journey with Swami continued thereafter. In 2013, we had done this drama on the life of Adi Shankaracharya. One more experience I think I should share. I always had a desire to do a drama on the life and message and mission of Adi Shankaracharya. He is one great spiritual leader whom Swami has spoken the most about after all the avatars. Rama, Krishna and the avatars is at the highest level. And then the second level, there are two great masters Swami has spoken about. One is Jesus Christ and Buddha, of course. And the other is Adi Shankaracharya. There is a great treasure of discourses of Swami explaining Advaita in the simplest way possible and exalting the contribution Adi Shankaracharya made in a life of just 32 years. So I was very inspired to do a drama, and that drama, we really worked hard to make it a very grounded research and a grounded drama in Swami's message of Shankaracharya. And we had a very nice team, we had a very nice cast, and the drama was received very well. But all through those 3-4 weeks, I had this concern in my mind. That year I was turning 32. So I had this concern in my mind. I said, Swami talks about Adi Shankaracharya, who lived for 32 years and did such extraordinary work that 1200 years later, he continues to inspire millions of people across the world. Jesus lived 32 years. And 2 millennia later, a billion people are inspired by his message. I said, I am turning 32. Swami places these icons before us so that we can learn from their lives. What have I done in my life? That I had not shared this with anybody. But this is what was my internal churning when this drama was happening. And then after the drama was over, it was very well received. We got great accolades nationally, internationally. I still remember the satisfaction and the boys learning from the drama had been extraordinary. So I had a dream after the drama was over a couple of weeks later. And Swami and I were sitting together. And I had asked the same question to Swami in my dream. So then Swami said in the dream, and I remember it very vividly. He said, "See, I will answer this question in your language. You are a researcher, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, Swami." He said, "What do you do as a researcher? Whatever research project you have undertaken, you first prepare a table of contents. This is what I'm going to cover in my research project. This is Swami's talking in the dream. This is what I'm going to cover in my research project. And then after identifying the core elements of your research project, you deal with each of them in enough depth. Swami said, same way, you should prepare a table of contents for your life. What is it that I want to achieve in this lifetime? And then each of those activities or initiatives or ideas or ideologies you want to achieve in your lifetime, you give full time to it and ensure that you achieve in the best way possible. I don't want quantity. I want quality. Don't compare yourself with anybody else. You do a good job, that will make Swami happy. I couldn't have got a better answer from anybody else, which convinced me that we all have a purpose in our life and we all have to work towards it with so much of commitment. And that is what Swami judges us on. He has given a unique role to every actor in this cosmic drama. And as a director, he is watching whether you are doing that role to your best ability or not. It is left to you whether you want to be living up to the director's expectations or not. And the size of the role doesn't matter. I remember in 2003, when we were doing the convocation drama, Ganesh, dancer, and who is also part of the Telugu team at Radio Sai, he had a very small role. He was a newspaper vendor in that drama. And his only dialogue was to come there on the stage and shout out, newspaper, newspaper. That's it. And we all had bigger roles, but he had only that small role. And after the drama was over, when Swami came on the stage, he didn't speak to anybody. He spoke only to Ganesh. He said, hey, newspaper boy, come here. And then Swami looked at him and he said, very good acting. Today's newspaper is tomorrow's waste paper. Such a small role he did in that 1 hour long drama. The Vice President of India, Bhairav Singh Shekhawat, had come as a chief guest, I remember that year. Swami remembered that two words, newspaper, newspaper, communicated a message to him and to us, gave a message about the ephemeral nature of the worldly success, but also communicated that even a small role done well will be acknowledged by the director. So I think that is the message which stayed with me in that dream. And that's been the way Swami has continued to communicate or share his inspiration at such fork-like situations when I have looked up to him. And then in 2013 also was a time when I was concluding my postdoc. So the university faculty, university administration was keen that I should join as a faculty. And Swami had always guided me at every level of my stay at Prashantanilayam, first physically and then in this fashion. So I said, I want some indication from Swami. So I will wait for that. So kindly permit me some time. So he, they said, fine, of course, they respect your direct internal connect with Swami. So I remember on the 1st of, I was waiting for some guidance, some indication from Swami. So on the 1st of September, I still remember that day evening, the Ganesha idols had come to the hostel. It was just on the eve of the Ganesha festival. And in there, again, I got one dream. And in that dream, I was sitting with Swami in the interview room. And I was asking Swami, what should I do? The university people want me to join postdoc. They want me to join as faculty. So then Swami said, I don't judge people by the number of years they stay here. I judge people by the commitment they show when they are here. Then he paused. He said, now Deshamilo, in my opinion, in your stay here, you have shown 100% commitment. I'm very happy. And then he indicated that after my postdoc, I should move out. I had never ever imagined that I will ever leave Prashantanilayam. First of all, I had never thought that I'll come to do my MBA and then stay back. After staying back, I never thought that there will come a time when I will have to leave Prashantanilayam and go. But he prepared me mentally. But what I realized later is that he had not only prepared me to leave, but he had also prepared the ground for me to continue my work in a very, very big way. So I had been writing a book on corporate social responsibility since 2011 with my former Professor Ramurthy from the School of Business Management here. And and he retired, so he left the completion of the book on me. And by 2013, I had finished that book on CSR. And that was around the time the Government of India was mandating corporate social responsibility. So the interest in CSR had gone up in a very big way. and around the same time, so October the act was passed, November my book got published by Springer. And as is the tradition, you usually send your books to subject experts to get their feedback. So I had sent them. So the previous May I had gone to US at a conference to present my work at Harvard. And I'd met a lot of faculty at Harvard and MIT and many other institutions. So I had shared my work, my book with them once it was released. And then I got very good feedback. And then in February 2014, there was this executive education program in Mumbai, which was a collaboration with Harvard University, World Bank and the Government of India on CSR. So this professor with to whom I had sent my book, he sent me a letter that we liked your book very much. Would you be interested to join us as a research faculty for this project and help us with the conducting of it? So I said, that's a wonderful opportunity to be associated with such eminent institutions. So I took permission from the university and it was a 4-day residential program. I had gone there, very well received. And at that time, they discussed more about the CSR work. I had already got this indication from Swami. So they said, would you be interested in doing a postdoc or an advanced research? So I said, yes, provided I get the right opportunity. So they said, okay, let us go and explore and we'll get back to you. And 2014 April, I winded up my postdoc and I left the institution. And 2014 May, I got the letter from Harvard Business School to join them as a visiting scholar. Now, visiting scholar position is given only to very eminent faculty who are subject experts. It was one of the first times they had given to someone who was a postdoc, who had not joined as a tenured faculty, though I was eligible, but Swami had told me to do postdocs, so I was doing that. So it was a great honor that I was invited by Harvard Business School for joining them as a visiting scholar. And I remember on 29th of April, that was the only day I was getting a ticket to leave Prashanthi Nilayam. I wanted to go on 30th or maybe even later, but the ticket was only on 29th. I wanted to go by train because a lot of luggage. And I left. And then a couple of weeks later, I wanted to see if there was any connection with the date when I left. So when I looked up the almanac, that day was Chaitra Amavasya. The day I had joined was Vaishakh Prathama. Now, Chaitra and Vaishakh are months next to each other. So I had been in Prashanthi Nilayam exactly for 12 years. Not a day more, not a day less. That was my visa to be in Prashanthi Nilayam, which was so precision, perfect planning, which only on hindsight you can remember as to, you can realize as to how Swami has a very clear-cut agenda for you and how he executes it when you arrive, when you leave. Everything is so picture-perfect planned by him. And then to conclude this part of the story, I left for US on the in September 2014. I landed there on 13th September. And 15th September was to be my first day at the Harvard Business School. So that day, early morning, I got a dream. Swami was coming in Darshan line. And walking and coming, and I was sitting in the students block. Swami came there. He smiled at me. He patted me. He spoke to me something. So I got darshan, sparshan, sambhashan. And then he left and went off into the interview room. And then I woke up and I realized that today I'm joining Harvard Business School. Today morning Swami came and gave me darshan, spoke to me, blessed me. And then my mind ran back to June 2002 when Swami had said in that interview that this boy was going to join Harvard University, yes, but he left that and came to stay with me at Prashanthi Nilayam. And how over the intermittent 12 years, Swami literally groomed me, inspired me, blessed me, trained me, and made me ready for whatever my purpose in this lifetime was. And then brought me back to where my father wanted me, that someday I should go to an international institution and get experience. And showed his hand then, showed his hand now, and it is the very same Swami, whether it is physical or in the metaphysical world, but it's the very same principle which continues to guide our lives. So that has been the kind of journey that I've had with Swami. Before I was born, I don't know, I mean, because you said I am a fourth generation devotee, in one of the interviews, And just to share how our connection with Swami is much beyond what we know of physically. In one of the interviews, I think it was a Chennai interview when he blessed us to go to Chennai. In fact, I still remember that incident in Chennai. I mean, the humility which Swami wanted us to learn when he used to talk. He told Mr. Chakravarti, we were five of us. So he told Mr. Chakravarti, these five boys speak very well. First of all, he asked Mr. Gokak, he was the vice chancellor. These five boys speak very well, so I want to take them to Chennai. You are the vice chancellor, so can they get leave? Imagine the chancellor asking the vice chancellor that these five boys
permission,
his approval whether these boys can get leave. And he said, Swami, it is a great opportunity for them to be with you. What better education than living with God? As they say, living with God is true education. Then he told Mr. Chakravarti, so here one permission. Then other permission. He said, tell Srinivasan, Mr. Srinivasan was the main organizer, All India president. He said, tell Srinivasan, these five boys speak very well. If he can make arrangements for them to accompany me in the flight, so that their ticket and accommodation arrangements can be taken care of, it will be very nice. So Mr. Chakravarti said, of course, Swami, it's a great opportunity. I will tell Srinivasan. Swami said, very happy. Then he said, see, I'm taking the five of you as my five life breaths.
Oh.
You must live up to my expectations and communicate the message of Swami to all the people in Chennai. There'll be so many people coming, chief ministers, governor, cabinet ministers, devotees. You must tell them with all the confidence and courage about what you've learned in Swami's institution. So in that occasion, Swami said, while he was talking about how each one of us were are good speakers in that context, where each one of us is from came in. Then in that context, he asked me where I am from. So I said, Swami, I am from Mumbai. Where do you stay in Marine Drive? Where do you stay? So I said, Swami, Marine Drive. Then he told in Telugu, which Mr. Giri translated to me after the interview is over. He said, yes, that land is not a natural geographic formation. It is reclaimed land.
Oh.
It has been reclaimed from the sea. That's a process of extending the land into the sea so that you can have land connectivity. Otherwise, these are all patches of islands. So later on, Mr. Giri said, Swami said, that is a reclaimed land. I said, yes, sir. It is called Back Bay Reclamation in the technical term. So in that context, Swami said, so how Swami used every opportunity to show his technical expertise also, because we usually forget who Swami is and hence presume that he has a specific spiritual domain expertise. But he used to never leave that opportunity to show his multifaceted nature. And in that he said, this boy, I heard him speak for the first time. He spoke even in First World Conference in Mumbai. Now, that was a decade and a half before I was even born. And in that interview, Swami said he spoke first time in the First World Conference. That time also he spoke very well. I remember him speaking. Same thing he had said in 2007 in May. This is 2006. In 2007 May, when we were in Kodaikanal, I gave a talk and then I came back. And then usually have this feedback session in the Sai Shruti Mandir. And Swami said, some of the elders said, Swami, Shashank spoke very well. Then a particular incident I had shared about one lady devotee from the 1960s, Konamma. Srimati Geetaram narrates that experience very often. She used to sell peanuts and then she used to get the hot water for Swami's residence. So I had narrated that experience and Mr. Giri and they said, Swami, that experience was very nice. He narrated it very well, very nice message communicating Swami's concern for devotees. You would have broadcasted it on another occasion. So Swami said, yes, this boy is there since those days and I give him opportunities to keep sharing those experiences so that he doesn't forget them. That was again 2 decades before I was born. So we really don't know how long has been our association with Swami. We don't know how he has been using us in order to further our own spiritual growth and in also further his larger mission of human transformation. The best we can do is to acknowledge the opportunity that we get and give our best at that point in time, whether it is as a student, I remember Swami used to, as a new student, I always used to wonder, what is it that will make Swami happy? So I'd asked one of my seniors. He had by then graduated. He was Amar Singh. He's in the US. So they used to come and we used to get an opportunity to interact with them. So I asked him, what will make Swami happy? I was a real fresh student then. So he said, Swami had told us once, we had asked him this question in the MBA interview. Swami said, three things will make me happy. First, study well. Because you have come here to study, so you should do your job very well. And that's why Swami always used to emphasize, O grade, 5 out of 5.
Yes.
That's the standard. We always wonder, why should that matter in your spiritual journey as to what grade you get? But if a person cannot excel in the physical world, which requires so much of discipline and commitment, how can he excel in the spiritual world? Because the same virtues of commitment and excellence are required in the spiritual world. So he said, first, study well, get O grade, Swami said. Second point, do well in whatever service opportunities you get when you are in the institution. You are in some self-reliance department, do seva there. Because you are getting free education, you should contribute back to the community. And after you do these first two things, do well in your studies, do well in your hostel duties, whatever free time you get, think of me. That is the best sadhana you can do. Swami always used to say, smarane tarano payamo, to think of God is the best solution to cross this samsara. So, whatever we do, whatever job lies before us as a student, in my life at least, as a student, as a researcher, as a coordinator of self-reliance departments, later as a teacher, and now in my work as a researcher and as an author, this lesson, this inspiration of Swami, that work is worship, whatever you do it well. Because that is your offering to God. Yoga, karmasu, kaushalam. Whatever you do it in the best way possible. Because that is the best offering that you can give to God. Because whatever you have is God's gift to you. And whatever you make use of that and offer it back is your offering back to God. It's that, as we were taught in awareness class, is the naivedyam prasadam cycle.
Yes.
What you get is the naivedyam and what you offer back is the prasadam. That I think is the best use of our skills, of our talents. And I think that's what distinguishes Sai students in the world outside. We may not be extraordinary in all the skills that our profiles, our careers may expect us to have at the beginning, but we pick them up on the way. But what really distinguishes each one of us from others is this inner commitment that whatever you do it well. And the second corollary which goes to that is, you do it well not because you will get something in exchange, but you do it well because you are offering it to Swami. And it is a matter of gratitude to Swami that He has given you whatever and you are offering it back to Him. And the joy, the smile, as we always say, we do everything to bring a smile on Swami's face. These are the two inner theorems which run parallelly in every Sai student's life. And that is what distinguishes them from other professionals, from their peers, from their colleagues. And I think that is the most extraordinary contribution of Swami. If I look back, there has been no other example, there has been no other parallel in the history, whether you see avatars, whether you see prophets, whether you see spiritual masters, where a master has given so much of his time, his energy and his message firsthand to the youth. And in Swami's lifetime, directly through the university and the educational institutions, and I'd done a rough back of the hand calculation, Swami would have molded directly, personally, nearly 25,000 students in his lifetime as a chancellor, physical chancellor of the university, one-on-one, groomed them into being those catalysts of change into wherever they go. And here another misunderstanding, that catalyst of change means you have to go and then change others. That's a misnomer. You don't have to change anybody. A catalyst doesn't change anybody. The word catalyst in chemistry means that by the mere presence of that chemical or that element, the reaction, the chemical reaction gets a different color and outcome. Similarly, by our very presence, by our conduct, by our behavior, by our performance, we should be able to change the ambience, the work, the outcomes of whatever we are associated with. And that's one compliment, and it's not because it's about me, but I always reflect back and say that how by our work and by our presence we are able to inspire others. And I remember My professor at Harvard met my parents once at an event in Mumbai, and he was talking to them, and he said, your son is a great researcher, a wonderful scholar, subject expert. Then he said, but all that is okay because many people have that. He's a great human being. He's a good human being. That is his most outstanding characteristic. Again, recently, another executive director of the Harvard Business School India Research Center, that lady met my mom in some context at a Harvard event. Same thing she said. He's a subject expert. He's great at his work. But then she said, but more importantly, he's a very good human being. She said twice. So I think that is what Swami wants us to be. While we are excellent in our work, the more distinguishing facet of us as Sai students, the greater responsibility of Sai students is this compliment that we are good human beings. And this is not going to come by achieving some key performance indicators or working on critical result areas. These are not going to make you a good human being. Everything you do, the way you do, why you do, how you do, all of this constantly is observed. And that cumulatively gives the impression that you are a good human being. And that is not our making. That is Swami's training. And that training has been given without any awareness that we are receiving it. We have been groomed like that mud which is groomed on that wheel by the potter. And the perfect, the pot that emerges is because of all the handiwork of the potter which makes us. But what is important is that after that pot is made, it is serves its purpose. What is that purpose? To fill water and stay cool. But Swami always used to give that example. That while the pot has the purpose of ensuring that the water is stored inside, in order that that water doesn't get evaporated, you have to ensure that the pot is surrounded by water outside also. So yes. The goodness, the skills, the training that Swami has given you will remain inside you as a pot, as this receptacle, this body. As long as the water outside, the goodness outside, the training outside is maintained by you, and you will not have a Prashanthi Nilayam wherever you go. So you have to create your own Prashanthi Nilayam wherever you go. And that is possible by good company. And good company is not of people, because that is also limited to time. How many people can you get? How much time can you get to stay with them? No, you won't get. So what is good company? Swami used to say, satsanga is satya plus sangha. The company of noble thoughts that you surround yourself with all the time is what will stay with you. That is the best company you can keep. And in my experience, after Swami left physically, my greatest experiential learning has been connecting with Swami through his message, through his discourses. I would have done a structured study of so many of Swami's discourses as I would do for research papers, and then listen to them. Summer course, 15 discourses. Kodai visit, 15 discourses. Dasara discourses, and then analyze the patterns of his message, and then try and work through that and understand what is the core of Swami's message. And in all the speeches that I get an opportunity to give to devotees, last 2 years I gave about 25 speeches across US, all across the coasts, at the different retreats, those discourses and the clarity that I received from that in Swami's message has enabled me to understand his message, his mission, his life in a very, very insightful perspective. And that is what I try to communicate. And when devotees hear that, they realize that there is so much more to Swami's life than all the miracles and all the larger than life experiences that we have heard and experienced. That is one part of it. But there is a much bigger part that Swami had come to give, which is his message. And first is understanding the message, secondly is internalizing. Then practice becomes natural. This process, I feel devotees need to embark on in a very, very focused manner. Extolling Swami's divinity is now not required because we know he is divine. How many times we keep telling Swami is divine, Swami is divine? You don't need to tell yourself again, she is my mother, she is my mother, she is my mother. We know that. We know Swami is divine. But what after that? What he has come to give us as divinity? How we can internalize and practice it? That is when his mission and his life's efforts, physical efforts, would be truly achieved. I guess that's the role of Sai devotees and students going forward.
I think the value that we give to a master, as they say, is how we master his values.
Yes.
And I think that is what is the summum bonum of the role that every student and every devotee has to play. And as you narrate your story, you know, one thing that occurred to me, which happened during your student days and which Swami reiterated it many times, is this question of priority. You know, at that point in time, you chose to be with Bhagwan. You wanted to make your life evergreen with divine love.
Yes.
And give up the green card of, you know, going to the US. And He will give you whatever is needed for you. If that has to come, it will come. You know, as choose the kingdom of God and everything else shall be added on to you.
Yes.
America or success, everything else will come to you, but you have to choose the divine.
Yes.
Once you choose the divine, everything else will automatically follow. And I think that's a very, very powerful lesson that Swami was trying to communicate through your experience to all of us.
Yes, I think so.
As you said, you know, it's not that I wanted to go. Yeah, you only once had that thought. You wanted to check with him. You know, you wanted to basically actually only sort of guide you and, you know, be with you in that decision.
Right.
But I think since you were so clear, even at that point in time, about your priority, he was only reiterating that.
Yes.
You know, even at that point, you didn't have a doubt. You were very clear.
Yes.
You know, you didn't ask Swami with 20% mind that if Swami says go to America, I will go to America. No, you are very clear that no, I want to be here. So I think that is something I think very, very, very powerful, and which Swami reiterated. And of course, once that is there, everything else automatically is taken care of.
Yeah, and where He wants you to land up ultimately is where He will take you. But what is your priority is what is the test. At that point in time.
Yes.
And once you choose God, I guess everything else gets added on to you. Swami used to say, no, I will not only give Annam, I will also give Amritam.
Amritam.
Which means I won't only give you the worldly requirements for your existence, whether it is money, success, fame, work satisfaction, social service, whatever is required, but also the ultimate.
Yes.
And only He can confer that, because we only have a capacity to achieve at a level after which it is His will and it is His grace. So I guess you've raised a very valid point. Yes, priority is something, but I guess even that is Swami's grace that you choose God over the world at a point in time, because in that adolescent mind with all the influences, and I was a typical metropolitan kid, so I had grown up with all the exposure to the world. But over how many lifetimes He has been molding each one of us, and I don't wish to take any credit for that priority. I guess we, each one of us, is an instrument in His larger mission.
Yes.
But I think we should have a passion to be that instrument.
Yes.
We should have a passion to contribute to His mission, because He has contributed so much Himself. I mean, look at the we all say, oh, we are contributing to Swami's mission, we are serving Him. But how much has He served His own mission? Yes. Over 85 years, how much of work, in my latest book, Divine Love, which Book Trust published last year for the World Youth Conference, I've literally quantified the number of interviews Swami would have given in His lifetime in Prashant, Vrindavan and Kodaikanal. I've given a number to that. So, and then I've given a number to the discourses He would have given here or in Vrindavan. And to add to that, how many organizational activities, these 200 schools, water supply projects, covering 20 million people, which is 2 crore people, equivalent to the population of some of the European countries, this entire medical mission, this 600,000 active workers in India, this 2,000 centers in 125 countries, and this direct physical motivation and inspiration to each one of us. If you just try to quantify it, forget His divinity, even at a human level, how much Swami has invested in this human race in a lifetime. If that doesn't light a fire in your belly, that if my master has done so much, what should I do so that that can continue to shine with all its effulgence? I guess that is the mandate before us.
Yes.
And I really feel inspired when I just think about this, that how much more we should be able to do, not what we've already done, but in the limited ticking time bomb that we are sitting on of our life, how we can contribute in every single day, so that when the lights go off, when the director says pack up, it's behind the scene when he meets you, he says chala santosham, I'm very happy, good job.
I think for that also Swami gave you that very beautiful direction about, you know, dropping your table of contents and then putting your act together, putting a plan together. You got to plan out your work and work out your plan.
Yes.
Of course, He will guide.
Yes.
But I think Purusha Prayatnam, as we were discussing, is so important. Then automatically divine grace will come.
No, both are equally important. Your self-effort and divine grace. I still remember in my, and I will conclude with that, in my MBA group discussion, there was this topic of human effort and divine grace. So I was fresh that time and I'd heard Dr. Jagdishan. So I'd repeated that. I said, God's grace is like the omnipresent wind. But the man who makes the effort to raise the sails of the ship crosses the ocean of the world and moves to the other side.
Yes.
So Dr. Sainath was the evaluator. So he was very impressed. In fact, he went and told everybody, the vice chancellor and the controller, that he gave a very good analogy. So Mr. Giri started my interview also. It seems you spoke very well in the GD, in the group discussion. What did you say? And I guess that has stayed with me, that we have to raise the sails of our ship.
Yes.
Because God's grace, to say that, oh, I have Swami's grace, or you have Swami's grace, or only XYZ had Swami's grace, is like saying that only some people get oxygen. Everybody else has to work for it. Everybody has oxygen. Everybody has divine grace. What effort we make to achieve it, yes, with the sense of understanding that without the wind, the sails won't work. And if we don't raise the sails, the wind won't help. That is the golden combination.
You just missed the opportunity. That's it. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Shashank. I know we've been talking for more than 90 minutes, and there is so much more that you can share about your trips with Bhagwan and about the beautiful experiences being in the hostel, being part of so many dramas, having this opportunity to speak in the divine presence. I know he would have given you a lot of tips about everything that you did as a student, and I think those are something which we really need to document about public speaking, about dramatics, about doing self-reliance activities, about editing Bhagwan's discourses. I think a lot of lessons that came to you directly and indirectly being part of so many activities that Bhagwan gave you to participate in, and I think we really need to document them going forward. So I'm really grateful to Bhagwan that we got started in this discussion, and I pray to him that we continue this as and when he wills, and take it forward to not only document them but disseminate them in a manner that more people derive inspiration from this. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bishu. It has been delightful for me to be back in Radio Sai, and as I said, this is our true home. And sharing our experiences and remembering those wonderful moments takes us back in time. And it reaffirms our own convictions as to how Swami has guarded every aspect of our life. And it also is an opportunity for introspection as to whether we continue to be on his track. So it's a great opportunity for me too. So thanks so much for having me here.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Okay, now since you're talking about linear programming, can you also share something? So, because you are a researcher, and you were in polymer engineering, and then I don't know what prompted you to go to computer science. Something about computer science would have definitely fascinated you. But as you research and as you look at what goes on into creating these algorithms and, you know, these softwares, high performance computing, do you also at some points see the supernatural in all these things? You know, are there any sort of supernormal moments in your research, you know, when you see that, wow, this is fantastic, you know, the way this thing is operating?
Well, rather, I would say that I'm seeing the limitations of the algorithms and the logic and all that in capturing reality, you know, because right now I'm actually working on research on simulation-based public policy analysis for health. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with public policy analysis, you need to look at the human aspect and the pure science aspect, right? Like, for example, right now we are looking at some disease spread. So the disease itself spread is, in some sense, natural science aspect, mm-hmm. but it also is impacted by how humans interact with each other mm-hmm. and with the environment. Mm-hmm. And then you see that, you know, a lot of the scientific models and all that are actually not very effective, especially when it comes to public policy level, because partly because the human aspect is difficult to model. And I think the traditional scientific belief has been that the human is pretty much a material system, right? So basically, Schrodinger's equation perhaps explains a lot of what is happening in the world. The only thing is it's too difficult for us to integrate it over the whole universe. I have heard physicists say that really all the problem in physics is computational because we need to integrate Schrodinger's equation over the whole universe. We can't do it. So the fundamental problem is computational. But actually when you look at it, when you're trying to model the human aspect and all that, you see that there are very serious limitations in science, and I think that is posing some very fundamental problems, and I think that actually comes from a view that the human is basically a material system, you know.
So because of your limited view of the human, you're not able to find go beyond that to see the solutions.
Correct. So basically the idea is how do we know that all these things work, right? So in science you try to identify some fundamental phenomena, model it, and maybe integrate with fundamental models for many different fields, and then try to get an idea for the whole system, right? So science traditionally developed through reductionism, where individual phenomena are studied very well. Okay, so right now there's a move towards integration, at taking a system level view, where you try to model the whole system. Okay, so in principle, if your model for all the individual components are very good, you should be able to model the whole system. But we can't model the whole system. Okay, so it really doesn't work out, and especially I think science has been very effective in physics, and to a large extent chemistry fundamentally is like physics, you know. But as you go, if you look at it from a philosophical perspective, you have Annamaya Kosha, Pranamaya Kosha, Manomaya Kosha, right? Physics is dealing with Annamaya Kosha, right? And when you deal with inanimate objects, I think science is doing a pretty good job. When you deal with Pranamaya Kosha, let's look at it as biology, right? Then you have a little bit more problems. When you look at mind sciences or psychology, you have even more problems. One fundamental belief in science is that of reproducibility. Forget about correctness. Correctness is necessary also, but if you don't have reproducibility, then everything else you have in science is meaningless, right? So you should, even if you're wrong, at least you should be able to reproduce the wrong stuff, right? So they tried to do some research and try to reproduce psychology results, and 2/3 of the results could not be reproduced. Okay, forget about correctness. You can't even reproduce your results, right? So all you explained about it, if it's not reproducible, you explained imaginary stuff. So then they said, okay, let's try this with other fields also, and similar in medicine, in biology, in economics. Right, in artificial intelligence, they say found the same problem of reproducibility. A lot of stuff cannot be reproduced, you know. So we are actually having very fundamental problems in science, and some of these have been published in top journals like Nature, Science, and all that. And the belief that science can explain the universe, I think, is very far-fetched. I think physics can explain the material universe pretty well, but I think when you get to life or the psychological aspects, I think the science's scientific method is not really strong enough, and I think it's very far-fetched to claim that science is explaining everything, so there's no role for the spiritual dimension.
Wow. I think I remember 2-3 thoughts come to my mind. One is that, as they say, that all the problems of the world are created by the mind. And I think it was Einstein who said that, you know, you have to go to a level above that to find solutions for it. The solutions are not at the same level at which the problems were created.
Yes. In fact, that is very insightful, because I feel that that is one aspect in which the Satya Sai University can actually contribute a lot in the future. You know, so right now, Satya Sai University has very good technical skills, especially in mathematics and all that. They have applied it to very interesting problems. Like, for example, there's a person who got a PhD here who used machine learning to identify retinal problems early in early stages through image analysis and machine learning and all that. You know, so they had done very interesting work. Okay, but in some sense, this work could also be done by an atheist, right? There's no fundamental way in which the spirituality has impacted it. My feeling is that Right now, there are a lot of social problems the world is facing, and it is, and people are expecting greater problems as artificial intelligence increases. Yes. You know,
that itself is a problem.
Yeah. So, because in some ways, the Industrial Revolution changed humanity, not just the economic system. It created an idea of a very material perspective, where the human is basically a consumer of economic goods and producer of economic goods. Yes. So the physical aspect of the human was, you know, if you're working primarily with your physical body, you are basically a cog in a factory or something like that, right? Mm. Intellectually, you are still, people could contribute a lot, people were into the intellect. So the physical dimension became less important for the human, and the mental dimension became very important, and the mental dimension was associated with logic, right?
Yes.
Now what artificial intelligence computers are saying is we are much better at logic than you humans are ever going to be, right?
Mm.
So if your idea of human is a logical system that consumes and produces, right, then the computer can do the logic much better.
Mm.
You can have robots that produce, right?
Mm.
And if the humans are consumed, how are you going to afford it, right?
Mm.
So there are solutions that people are proposing in the West, because on the whole, the West has fallen for the totally materialistic idea of human, right?
Yes.
And so they're proposing solutions like guaranteed minimum wage for everyone. That is, whether you work or not, you'll be given a certain salary.
Mm.
Okay. But generally, people are not consuming machines. So when salaries, when you get welfare checks, for example, people are not getting a sense of fulfillment. So places where you have welfare, high welfare and all that actually have crime and drug addiction and all that. I don't know if you know, but many, the majority of demographic groups in the U.S., their mortality rate is actually going down.
Mm.
You know, while in India, generally the health is going up, right?
Mm.
Here the mortality is going down because people are committing suicide, taking opium, opioids and all that, you know. And clearly this totally idea that job is only a production mechanism is not right, you know. Job is actually karma, which actually gives you fulfillment in life, right? So right now, all the solutions that are being proposed are coming only from a purely materialistic perspective.
Yes.
So I feel that the Satya Sai University can come up with an alternative philosophical system, right, which says we are more than the material, we are more than a mind, right, this higher level that you talked about, right? And then come up with a both economic and technical solution, because it's going to be we are entering a digital era where the computers are going to play a major role, right? So how can technology help create a society and an economic system that will support your metaphysics, a physical assumption that you are more than a mind, right?
Hmm.
So, for example, you have, let's say we take something like handicraft, right? In India, a lot of people buy handicraft because of the way it was made by hand, right?
Yes.
Khadi and all that, because it was made in a certain manner. That is, it's not only the product you are consuming also the method in which it was produced, that is, did give meaning to the person and all that, right? And now you have something like Amazon Marketplace where you could actually sell it all around the world. So you may have only a very small fraction of the marketplace, but that's, the market is still is the whole world. So the technology is giving you a solution where you can actually make it economically feasible. And if more and more people say that I will actually be willing to pay more for something that is produced in a meaningful manner, you may have a sufficient large market. So where, you know, you could have the computer science department, the economics department, management department all work together using a philosophical foundation that is more Eastern, right? And then try to create a new type of economy and new kind of society, which is an Indian type of philosophy, you know, because if you think about it, for most of human history, India has given the foundation for meaningful life for most of humanity.
Yes.
Because India East onwards, which I try to call it Dharmic Asia, because both Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism all believe in the principle of Dharma, right?
Yes.
That actually had a majority of the world economy and majority of the world poverty. population.
Yes.
So the intellectual tradition, and there was a strong intellectual tradition like Adi Shankara, Ramanujacharya, all that.
Yes.
They actually had very logical systems, like Ramanujacharya, in fact, changed logic systems in India and all that. You know, so right now, what we see is, at the university, we have a very strong technical section now. We have a very strong spiritual aspect in terms of how the students are raised. If you could link them through the intellectual tradition includes the philosophical foundations, right?
Mm-hmm.
You publish papers on this philosophy, come up with an economic system, come up with a technological solution that can provide an alternative to the materialistic worldview that actually works, then I think India and the university would be playing a very important role in solving a major social problem that is going to come with the rapid progress in artificial intelligence, which questions basically what is the human, you know. And what we have to say is the human is more than a mind, the human is more than a logic system, so we can actually come up with an economic system and a social system where which is sustainable and fulfilling to the people, and we'll prove it by showing its sustainability.
Wow. I think from artificial intelligence, perhaps you have to move out artificial intelligence, you know, intelligence that needs to have a heart. You cannot you cannot take the heart out of intelligence.
Yeah.
I think as Professor Venkatraman used to always quote this saying that, you know, knowledge without compassion is useless. And compassion without knowledge is again, you know, meaningless.
Yeah.
So I think that is something you have to bring in intelligence as well as bring in compassion.
Correct.
And, you know, and that happens only when you recognize the human as a composite entity of body, mind and soul. You can't think about, like in the West, the human to be just the body. He's not a man, he's not a social animal.
Or the mind, you know.
So, so I think only when that perspective comes in, then you have enlightened thinking, getting into your solution making using technology.
So what I find missing on the whole in India at this stage, is at one end you have people practicing individual spirituality very well, right? The heart, compassion, all that is there. And then you have a technical intellectual education where you have very good techniques, machine learning, this, that and all that. We have very good people, and in fact Satsai University also has very good people in all that, right? What I find missing is that in the earlier days, like when you have Ramanujacharya and all that, there was also a very strong intellectual tradition. India had its own logic system and all that, you know, which were actually much more flexible to handling uncertainty, error and all that than classical logic that comes from the Greek tradition. So my feeling is that we need to revive that intellectual tradition. So it's not just saying that we'll have compassion, but how do I create an economic system that actually
is based on that tenet?
So we need to have that intellectual aspect integrated with spirituality.
I mean, the your intelligence should be based on Eastern philosophy, on the Indian philosophy.
Yeah.
I think now what is happening is most of the time, you know, even though we are in India and, you know, we may even believe these sort of or subscribe to these kind of tenets of Indian culture and philosophy. But when it comes to intellectual stuff, we look at the West and we look when we see what they have done, and you know, then we get influenced by that.
Yeah, and we need to recognize that there are these problems that are happening with using science and all that to deal with the human aspect, you know, that we are facing severe limitations and that I think that there are advantages and disadvantages to both Western and Eastern philosophy. It's not that one is inherently superior, but I think we need to recognize that we need to look at alternative systems too. So I think it'll be really great if you know, the Satya Sai University can take a leadership role in trying to fill that intellectual gap right now that India is not offering in terms of the social philosophy and all that based on a perspective that is beyond the material.
I think that is that, and that is where India needs to move forward in its intellectual pursuits.
Correct.
Where, you know, all the philosophy finds expression in practical economic models.
Yes, correct.
And I think so in your interactions with the students and the faculty in the Satya Sai University, have you seen any work in that direction, or have you interacted on these lines with the faculty here?
I was just talking today to Professor Pallav Barua. He's the head of the department, and the reason I talked about him is I have been thinking about this a little bit, and initially I said I thought that maybe once I retire I will go full-fledged into this path and go. Mm. And then he was giving an interesting talk where he was actually saying maybe we should try to integrate yoga, mathematics and computer science, you know, and I think some people are a little skeptical, but I actually thought it was very insightful, you know, mm-hmm. because we need to break down all these barriers,
yes.
our self-imposed barriers, you
yes.
know. So I was talking to him about this and he kind of thought it was quite fascinating because I didn't explain everything fully because it's not a technical discussion, but there are a lot of mathematic aspects in terms of the logic system used and all that. I believe the fundamental difference between some of the Indian philosophy and Greek philosophy, which lay the foundation for Western tradition, is based on the logic differences in the logic system. And there's a lot of mathematical aspect, you know, because logic is an aspect of mathematics.
Yes.
You know, what we are using traditionally in mathematics now is classical logic, but the people have come up with many alternative logic systems, you know. So it is something that, you know, the mathematics department can also contribute to by looking at very fundamental issues, because I think right now what we are facing is some really fundamental problems in the application of science and the totally materialist philosophy when it comes to large-scale systems. You know, you can do simple things,
yes.
But you can't do large things. For example, you know, you might have heard of game theory, right?
Yes.
And I think game theory has been a big failure, right?
Mm.
So in economics, for example, they are using behavioral economics have been more effective than game theory, right? Because the idea that humans are always looking at things from a economic perspective or return on investment kind of thing is not really true, you know. It may work in very simple cases like am I buying a stock at this price or that price,
yes.
but when you look at the whole society,
yes.
that's not what happens. So you're seeing big political changes in the West also. People are unhappy. Well, I think the whole model is actually facing a severe problem, you know.
And I think you know, given the amounts of money that are being spent in policies and on which are based on economic models which are to some extent very shallow, because you are looking at the human body as maybe one tenth of what it truly is, and I think, you know, at times when I feel that, you know, we have spent so much money in which could have been spent much more wisely, you know,
yeah.
If only we had broadened our perspective, if only to some extent, you know, we had, as Swami says, you know, spirituality is 1C and, you know, science is 1C. Science is always, you know, it's incomplete.
Mm.
So only when you bring in spirituality, then, you know, science completes itself.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. So that perspective is perhaps what will take us to an enlightened century,
yeah.
if it happens.
Yeah, yeah. And one way of thinking of it is Swami is posing us a challenge.
Yes,
he is posing a challenge to the Satya Sai University,
yes, yes.
that you establish this truth, right?
Wow.
So we need to actually, you know, when you look at times of Ramanujacharya and all that,
yes.
right? They had atheistic philosophies, right?
Mm.
They had people who had a very purely materialist view. Yeah, of course, the Charvakas, right, mm-hmm. who are somewhat like postmodernists now. You know, they believed only in terms of pramana, they believe only in the experience. You know, what was observed, pratyaksha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you had slightly materialist philosophy, more like science, which believed in anumana and pratyaksha, that is, in some sense, logic and in empirical observation, right? And Ramanujacharya, Adi Shankara and all disproved these philosophies, right? So, and then they said, here's my philosophy, you try to disprove it. If you're not able to disprove it, then you have to accept that what I'm saying is the most valid explanation we have now, right?
Mm.
So we need to really think about, similarly, what does it mean? You know, like physics and all that, it's not like it's wrong, you know, it's our argument is that it's incomplete, right?
Yes, incomplete.
So then you have to make an argument that it is,
yes.
incomplete by saying that at a large scale it's not able to do, not just it's not able to do now, it cannot do it even,
yes.
in the future, right?
Yes.
So we need to have a really strong intellectual argument about that. So what I see with Swami's statement is that it was a challenge that he posed for us to fulfill. You know?
Yes, yes, fantastic. In fact, I mean, just to give an example from a different discipline from health, like for example, you know, we know about Ayurveda in India. It's been like the tradition for ages. It is there in the Vedas and all that. But now you have some people. I know of a very distinguished doctor who's actually heading one of the departments in Johns Hopkins. But he has moved into Ayurveda, inspired by Bhagwan, and he has now created models, you know. So he's explaining Ayurveda through experimental models, and in the language that an allopathy doctor also can understand, and you know, the scientific community also can relate to with data, with experiments, and all that. So that definitely has greater acceptance to the to the generation and to the intellectuals of the time. So probably something like that needs to be done, where you know you take these philosophies, and they are not just philosophies; they are the solutions. For today's problems, and see how we can create models out of them which work for to solve the problem of the masses.
Yes. However, I feel that at some point we also need to not dilute the metaphysics based on which Ayurveda is produced, right? Ayurveda is actually based on a spiritual metaphysics where, you know, at from the Mahat onwards, you come down at all these levels, you have to actually purify, right? So if we explain it to allopathy, saying with a very materialistic kind of thing, that is like as if it's the chemical reactions of the drugs that are making difference, then you're actually not proving your point, you know. So if you want to prove your point, you have to say, okay, this is my
system.
This
is where it stops.
Based on my philosophy.
Yes.
Here's your system, right?
Yes.
And I can do something your system cannot explain.
Cannot explain.
So for example, the mind-body connection, right?
Yes.
Initially, if you look at it fundamentally, initially even the medical doctors were actually not accepting the mind-body connection because now they accept it, but it's kind of an artificial fit to the whole system. But if you look at the Indian system, Ayurveda and all that, the mind-body connection is very naturally comes out of it.
Yes.
You know? So you didn't have to artificially fit it after resisting it for a long time. So in those senses, you know, we had to really come up with a fundamental philosophy and say, based on my philosophy, all these are can be observed. Based on your philosophy, you can't explain it easily.
Yes.
Okay, so my philosophy is more complete than
what
you have.
I mean, Ayurveda looks at the whole body as one system. They don't look at each organ as separate.
Yeah.
And the Vata, Pitta, Kapha, you know, is mapped to the Sattva, Raja, Tama, the gunas.
Yeah.
So,
and those themselves are mapped to the elements.
Elements.
You know,
they are mapped to the elements. So, So yes, I think more work in this direction perhaps will open up more brilliant minds into these kind of modes of thinking, and I think that is when perhaps we'll find enlightened solutions for today's problems.
Yeah, correct. You'd have studied the Boolean logic and all that, right? And Boole was actually a big follower of Indian philosophy. And his wife, I believe, wrote a letter to an Indian scientist called Bose, who was very famous at that time, saying that the Indian way of doing things, you know, the scientific discoveries over there could not have been done using the modern scientific method. There must be something else, some other way in which they actually accomplished this. And instead of just following the current science, maybe you should examine how they actually came up with their solutions, right? But it was never followed up, but I think it'll be interesting to look at it that way, you know. So basically, I think Western science has a major achievement, right? It's one of the clearly one of the major accomplishments of humanity, you know. But to assume that it's the same as truth is incorrect, you know. So different, it's a means of obtaining knowledge. And like any means of obtaining knowledge, it has weaknesses and strengths. So while appreciating it, we should also understand its limitations and see if alternative means can actually complete it. You know?
Yes. I think that's what Swami Vivekananda many years ago, you know, when he went there, I mean, he saw the West and he saw their passion to for development. He saw their passion to harness the power of science. So, so, and he said that is fantastic. And then he came to India and he saw that, you know, it has such great minds. It has such great people, you know, people who can just have so little and yet be so happy. You had, you know, you had these kind of people. At the same time, you know, there was a lot of poverty. So he was constantly worrying about this, you know, how can we bring both?
Yeah.
Because that, that is where, the golden solution lies for the world problems. And I think perhaps with Swami coming and with Swami setting up this university, as well as having a lot of people thinking about these lines, perhaps I think we are seeing a growing consciousness on these lines, isn't it?
Yes, correct. Yeah,
there is a greater acceptability now than perhaps 50, 60 years ago about the limitations of science and about how probably we should be looking for something little beyond this.
And I feel that on the whole, young people in India are getting more self-confidence, that they are not embarrassed about their past, you know.
So absolutely,
Europeans went through a stage where their renaissance, where they looked to their past, and their enlightenment and all that happened much later, you know. So we really need to first stop feeling embarrassed about the achievements of the past, and we need to also, I think, basically look at the intellectual achievements, not just limit ourselves to the spiritual achievements, you know.
And I think that's a very important point, and this is what I also see very often now, you know, the current generation, unlike say 20-30 years ago, you always looked at the West and you thought that, you know, whatever is happening there is the way the humanity should be and the progress of the humanity should be. But now you have the current generation, the millennials also, they take great pride in their culture, even if they are not confirming everything to the culture, they value it, and, you know, as you said, they're not ashamed of it, and they take pride in being what they are, and it is no more that thing that, you know, only if I go to America I become great, I can be in India and I can I can still, you know, have the world look at me with pride. So I think that is slowly happening. And I remember Swami saying so many occasions that India is the leader of the world, and India is going to lead the world. So I think we are seeing things happening there in that direction.
The only thing that concerns me is that sometimes a lot of the people are taking the easy way out and kind of exaggerating stuff and not really understanding the real contributions. I think India made enough real contributions that we don't need to come up with fake contributions, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think especially understanding the intellectual contributions of India, both in terms of logic and in terms of linguistics, I think would be very useful for the future.
Fantastic. So coming back to the university and your association with the university, you know, you have taught students there in Florida State University, and you've been in the University of California, and now every year you come and teach the students here in the Satya Sai University. How has this experience been, you know? What do you see here that you don't see in the U.S., or what do you see in the U.S. that you don't see here?
In terms of the intellectual aspect, it was very good. You know, when I first, after 2004, I came the next summer, so I was going to teach a course. So I teach one course on complexity of algorithms, which is a little bit more theoretical, and an advanced algorithms course, which is actually algorithms, which is more practical. So when I asked Pallav Bharwa, which he would like me to teach, he said, include both material, you know. So basically I taught about 1.5 courses worth of material in 2 weeks in Parthi, you know, and the students actually handle it very well.
Oh,
and the reason is most of the M.Tech students over here have very strong mathematical skills, because they have an MSc in mathematics, right? So for example, I would, a lot of computer science actually at the algorithmic level has very difficult problems because it deals with discrete systems. If the discretization assumption is relaxed to make it continuous, then mathematics has very easy solutions to those problems. So what you do is you take the discrete system and relax it, make it continuous, find a mathematical solution and discretize the system back. Okay? So you need to know mathematics very well to come up with such algorithms. Right? So I teach usually to the computer science students, I have to teach linear programming because they don't know linear programming in the US. But here, these people have taken one course on linear programming already. Right? So I didn't need to go over all those details, so I was able to cover the material very well. And in many cases, usually I didn't teach the algorithm. I would ask them to come up with the algorithm by giving hints, you know, and someone or the other would actually come up with the solution, you know. So it was a mathematically students are very strong. Mm-hmm. And since 2005, the importance of mathematics has increased mm-hmm. because machine learning also requires a lot of mathematics, right?
Yeah.
So I think our students here are in a very good position to actually contribute to the high end of computer science. And I think a lot of people who have seen the students actually do feel that we have one of the really strong computer science degrees in India, at least in India, you know, and perhaps even outside India.
Mm.
The only thing is that because so few students are graduating, it may not have spread as fast as if you had 100 students graduating, but I haven't seen anyone who has actually employed our students or had them as grad students and who does not have a good impression of the education provided here, you know. So I think technically the students are very strong in mathematics. That is one of the, I think, real strengths over there.
And so that is the technical side. And the behavioral side or the other, the culturally, do you find anything different in the students here?
I think one thing is, in India, students at all universities are very polite when you're the professor, right?
Mm-hmm.
They are always very well-behaved in front of the adults, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I often keep in touch with many of the students after they have graduated also.
Mm-hmm.
But many of them are actually following the values even after they leave. They may not wake up at 4:30, okay? But other than that, I think a lot of them are still maintaining the basic spiritual disciplines and, you know, the helping the university and all that, you know. So in the U.S., one of the things they do to cultivate school spirit is to have big football programs and you know, so that they'll have parties just for the football match and that way they cultivate school spirit, you know. And here, it is done in a different manner as people do seva and all that, right? So I think in some sense, the school spirit is being cultivated in a sattvic manner, you know. So, so students are helping the university much later. Just one example is, I actually worked with some students here when the cell processor first came out to publish some paper related to that. And the cell processor was commercially not out then. So we collaborated with IBM and we had to give it our code to IBM where they would run it. So one of the old students was there, you know, and his name was not on the paper, but he was still running the code at midnight and all that, you know, because we are approaching the deadline to get our work done, you know. So it was purely out of the school spirit that he was kind of
Selflessness
helping out, right?
Was there.
Right. So I think it basically shows that you don't need to have parties and football to get cultivate the school spirit. You can actually cultivate in a manner when you are actually contributing to society also.
Two more questions. You know, you as a person, before coming to Swami and before being exposed to Swami's teachings, and you as a person, after you got more into Bhagwan and his teachings, what is the difference?
I think the fundamental difference is really in not looking at the external situation for fulfillment, you know. Because I have generally always thought that something external, if I change, I went to the U.S. first because I felt there was something missing in India, right? So then I went to the U.S. I still found something missing. So it was after I got to spirituality, I really found what was missing. Of course, I could have got it in India perhaps, right? But it was God's will that I had to go to California to experience that, you know. So that idea that once you lose the idea that you need the external situation to change for fulfillment, you can accomplish a lot because you're no longer trying to say, I'm going to optimize my resume, I'm going to optimize something, right? So you kind of do something because it's a good thing to do. And I think in the profession also, you get respect because of that. People realize that, you know, for example, if you publish a paper, it's because you believe you're contributing something. It's not just because you wanted to publish something, so you wrote the paper, right? And they realize that you're doing something to help others, so they are willing to help you do that, you know, because most people are good people, you know, everywhere in the world, and they recognize, you know, when someone is trying to do it for, are they doing something for the selfish end, or are they trying to do something for a common good, you know, and people are willing to contribute to the common good once they see others also doing that.
And you definitely get more respect when people see that you're always thinking beyond yourself.
Correct.
Your selfish self.
Yeah, the credibility is very important, you know.
And did you ever ever speak about the students here or the university here with your colleagues there in Florida or in the U.S.?
I've talked a lot, you know, and especially we organize an international conference in India on high performance computing, which is probably one of the top conferences that are held in India. And lots of the people now actually respect the Satya Sai University, because not just talk, but the students have actually gone there and won awards and all that, you know. So people respect the intellectual quality of the work. In fact, many of the people who organized the conference have actually come over here and given talks and all that, and been very impressed by it, you know. So on the whole, I think more than just the talking, exposing them to the Satya Sai students, and yes. I think the students speak for themselves.
Wow. So in 2004, you started visiting the university, and after that, you've continued even post 2011. How was April 2011 for you? How did you take that, and what motivates you even now to come back every year?
It was a very traumatic experience. I had actually come to India then. In mid-2010, I took a sabbatical, and I was thinking that maybe I'll even move to India permanently. And then, but I didn't like the experience of actually living in India and working in India. I think it's a great place for retirement, but I wasn't ready for that. And on top of that, you know, that year my father died, and 1 month later Swami left his body, right? So I was coming occasionally to Puttaparthi, but not as often as I would have liked. And it was kind of a very difficult experience. In March, that's when my father died, and April is when
Swami
passed away. So I spent about 1 month in Chennai, you know, when my father was in ICU for a month or so. And then I remember before Swami passed away, I actually visited the university to interact with students and all that. And you know, I kind of just stopped on the way. I just stopped the car in front of Swami's hospital, you know. So that was kind of the last time I was close to Swami in the physical body, you know. So it was kind of a very a traumatic experience, you know. So I think it, and when I, made me even more, I felt that it was even more important for me to come to Puttaparthi then, because when Swami was there, it's easy to get people to come, but when Swami is not there, it's even more important for us to make sure we don't let the university down, you know, because that is his mission, you know. So that made me determined that I should
continue with this,
come back often.
Wow. And I think I just like someone said, you know, I remember many years ago when I asked one of the visiting professors, you know, he was coming for the Department of Management, and Swami was in Vrindavan, and you know, at that point in time, and all the teachers had gone to Vrindavan, and so, but this teacher was still in Parthi and, you know, taking classes. So when someone asked him that, you know, why are you still here? You know, everybody's gone to Vrindavan, you're the only one there. So he said, well, when the owner of the house goes, then it's the job of the gardener to look after the flowers.
That's a nice thing.
So he thought that, you know, it's my responsibility now to take it forward, and I have to preserve everything that the master has set in place. And it's really so beautiful that, you know, Swami has inspired you to continue, and I'm sure you're loving it, and I'm sure that, you know, this beautiful relationship will further enrich each other's lives as we go on this journey to, you know, to one day become one with Swami. Thank you so much, sir, for coming to the studios.
Thanks for the opportunity. It was really nice talking to you.
Sairam, sir.
Sairam.